today we are very lucky to have Thomasina Moore with us, who is going to be discussing taking and defending deposition. We have provided some materials that Liz Damsky sent out yesterday, so I would encourage you to pull those up if you haven't already printed them out. Thomasina is the founding partner of Thomasina Moore, PA, which is a civil litigation firm with an emphasis on consumer financial litigation and civil appeals. She's previously been an attorney with several large firms, including Bush Osberger and Lynch, Butler and Hosh, Rumberger, Kirk and, Caldwell, and then Anderson Moss, Shiraz, I'm probably mispronouncing that, and Petros. She's also been an attorney for the Second District Court of Appeal. So at this point, I'm going to hand it over to Thomasina, and I'm sure she'll take questions at the end of the call. So if you could hold your questions till she's finished presenting, because we are, as always, we are recording this, and it will be posted on the Internet, and we like to, you know, we don't want to have the interruptions of the questions throughout the call.
Thank you, Mary Kay.
Thanks, Thomasina.
I'm excited to be talking about depositions today because I do think depositions are one of the most important practice areas for the attorney, and for dependency attorneys, it's particularly important given the discovery you can take.
I'll come back after. I don't think
I am going to discuss six areas today, including understanding the different types of depositions. Preparing for depositions, making objections, introducing and using exhibits, lastly, some motions for protective orders. Beginning with understanding the different types of depositions.
So, Thomasina, I'm going to interrupt you for just a second. I hear a lot of background noise, so if you guys can please make sure you've muted your phone so it doesn't interrupt the speaker. Thank you.
Starting with understanding the different types of depositions, there are basically three types of depositions. They are discovery depositions, depositions which are used to preserve testimony, and then depositions that are known as containment depositions. Discovery depositions are just what they sound like. They are used to get as much information as you possibly can from the witness. In a discovery deposition, you want to ask anything and everything you can think of. Who, what, where, when, how, why, ask all of it, and go down the answers, follow every path, get as much information as you can. I would suggest for dependency depositions that you also ask witnesses what are known as emotion questions, how do you feel at that time, what were you thinking. I think given the issues you deal with, those type of questions would be much more beneficial than, say, in the civil context, which I generally deal with. In the discovery deposition, the scope of it is limited by Rule 8.245 and Subdivision A. And basically, for discovery, you can obtain discovery regarding any matter, as long as it's not privileged, that is relevant to the subject matter of the pending action. When you're taking the deposition, it's important to keep in mind the remainder of that provision, which states that it is not ground for objection, that the information sought will be inadmissible at the hearing if the information sought appears reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. I think I can make an argument that just about any question asked could be reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. So again, make your questions as broad as possible. The second type of deposition is a deposition that's used to preserve testimony. If you anticipate a witness will be unavailable, you're going to want to use a deposition designed to preserve that testimony. Most often, I think you will find that the deposition for preserving testimony will be that of an expert witness. And Rule 8.245 G3 goes through when you can use depositions for substantive evidence based on unavailability, and it specifically lists witnesses that are expert or skilled witnesses. If you're taking the deposition of an expert witness, there are certain additional questions you're going to want to ask. For expert witnesses, you want to make sure that you ask what their qualifications are, what's their background, what education do they have, CLE courses, seminars, teaching experience with this type of work or cases. Go through their opinions with them. and this in an expert witness deposition is very important. Make sure you elicit each and every opinion.
The way
that I do that is to repeat back to the witness what they've already told me their opinion is. If they tell me, well, I believe that the answer is A, that's my opinion. And I would always ask them if
it's he's your big friend with the Harvard ring.
It also B. If it's A and B.
You know who that is? Who has
is there anything else?
The guy was he always, I don't know,
Christina, I hate to interrupt, but someone, we can hear your conversation and it's interrupting, so please put your phone on mute. Thank you.
That's okay. Just keep repeating it back to them. If they're giving you opinion about what the sun looks like and they tell you it's round, ask them, all right, it's round, anything else? It's round and it's yellow. It's round and it's yellow, anything else? It's round, it's yellow, it hurts when you look at it. Just keep asking them until they get to the point where they say there's no other opinion and the list is exhausted. Once you get all of their opinions, make sure you ask them the bases of their opinions. How did they come to that conclusion? Who did they talk to? What did they read? What documents were they provided? Go through all of it and make sure that, again, that you exhaust that. Once you go through what bases they have and what they referred and what information they had, find out what the source of the information was that they relied upon. Maybe there is incomplete information or the source itself is subject. If the source came from interviewing a parent, maybe that makes it suspect for relying upon for an expert opinion. Make sure you ask the source. Another thing you can ask expert witness for impeachment particularly is about their fees. If you look at 1.280 in the Rules of Civil Procedure, which would be applicable here, take a look. It sets forth what you can ask about fees. You can ask them what their fees are, if they intend to testify for this party, or I would use lawyer in this instance in the future, how many times have they testified for this lawyer. Go through all of that, get your impeachment information if there is any. If they're just a parent expert, you know, make that evident on the record. Ask them if they had sufficient information or if there's additional tests or sources of information that they should have had in order to reach their conclusion or which could negate their conclusion. You might want to be careful asking that of your own witness here, of course, but if you're asking the other party's witness, make sure you ask those questions. Ask them about the certainty of their opinion. Can they testify about that within a reasonable degree of medical certainty? Make sure you go through all of that. Again, if it's an opposing party's expert or a parent's expert in this case, ask them if there's possible explanations which would be contrary to their own opinion. Ask them for other potential answers, which would, again, undermine it. And then ask them about any familiarity with any treatises you might rely upon. Say you have an article on child time and what it means to them, and you want to get the court to review the article or consider the article on child time for your best interest opinion. Ask the expert if they're familiar with that. If they are familiar with it, if they say that the source of the information, even the journal that it's published in, is a reliable source, that will help you get that introduced when it's time for you to present your case. The last type of deposition is what's known as a containment deposition. The containment deposition is used to limit testimony in certain areas. You're going to want to use a containment deposition and nail a witness down. Say you have someone that at this time tells you they're willing to testify for you, but you're afraid they're going to change their mind. It's a relative who a few months from now might not want to say something against their brother or sister, something along those lines. Do a containment deposition and ask them only about the specific points that you think that they might change their opinion or their testimony on later. When you do a containment deposition, you want to make it short. It's exactly opposite of the discovery deposition. Don't go through everything. Don't ask every open-ended question. Short, concise, get to the point, and get right back out. No matter which of the type of depositions you're asking, though, there's certain procedural things you should do both at the beginning and the end of the deposition. At the beginning of the deposition, you're going to want to introduce yourself. Explain to the witness they have to respond verbally, to wait till you have finished your question before they respond. You want to instruct the witness to let you know if they don't understand a question and that by answering it, it will be assumed that the question was understood. I like to tell the witness they can take a break whenever they need one. I don't want them to feel they're under duress, and I want to ease some tension there so I feel like I get more candid response. However you want to develop that spiel, as I call it, at the beginning, go through that, those questions. There's additional questions you want to ask at the end. At the end of the deposition, you want to make sure you ask the witness whether they fully understood the questions, whether they answered every question truthfully, and whether the witness would like to change the answers to any question. Once you've done all of that, you can move on and go ahead and finish up your deposition, although I'll talk about that, some things you should do before you finish a little later as well. Another question is, when should you take a deposition? When is it appropriate? The cost and time needed for a deposition was raised as a question today. It can be time-consuming, but there's very few instances where you're not going to want to take a deposition. One of those, of course, is if you have a friendly witness. If you have a witness that you are sure is going to testify the way you want them to, you don't want to take their deposition unless you think there is a need to preserve the testimony. The more questions they're asked by opposing counsel, the more grounds for impeachment that could be come up and be used later, even on small, minute details. The other time you don't want to take a deposition is if you have a hostile witness and you already have a sworn statement. Perhaps they were in a criminal proceeding and you have their trial testimony. If you have that, if you take another deposition, you give them a chance to explain it away or to practice their answers and to get more comfortable with it. And you don't want to give them that opportunity. So those are two times when you don't want to take depositions. Other than that, if it's not scheduled by the department and you feel you need it, go ahead and take the depositions. More is better, not less. Once you get a deposition set, there's certain things you should routinely do in order to prepare both yourself for a deposition, and if you're defending the deposition, things you need to do to prepare the witness for the deposition. For attorney preparation, there's the obvious and the basics. You need to review the file. Talk to all your witnesses. If there's articles out there, treatises that you think you're going to need, particularly with an expert witness, read those ahead of time. Make some questions from them. You want to prepare an outline of your questions. Your outline you can organize in a way that suits you best. You could do it by a timeline, by issues, by defenses, however you feel most comfortable with, and that may change based on each case and each witness. And when you're doing it, if you're preparing an outline for a discovery deposition, remember the rules of evidence don't apply here. Open-ended questions, make them as broad. Ask any question you think is reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. One thing about the outline, though, is when you prepare the outline, be flexible with it. Don't just routinely go down the outline. You're going to get thrown curveballs. It happens. I had a deposition where I started one time, and I asked the witness their name, and they told me they couldn't tell me they were in the witness protection program. Now, if I just went down my outline, my next question would have been, what's your address? But you don't want to do that. You want to follow the path that the witness leads you down and then go back to your outline and finish up those questions. And that's the one thing I would say before you finish and ask those last three questions I mentioned earlier. When you're done and you think you've asked everything, take time and review your notes, review your outline, and make sure that you've asked any follow-up questions you feel you need. My follow-up questions, while a witness is giving an answer, I use a red pen, and I put a question mark in the margin so I can't miss it. And I go back and make sure I've checked off every one of those questions before I finish. I like to take a break before I adjourn my deposition. I take a bathroom break, I walk around, I think about it for a few minutes, and make sure there's nothing else. Because one thing about depositions is you don't get another shot usually. And if you don't ask now, you're not going to get a chance to ask later. So take your time and make sure you really are done before you adjourn the deposition. One other thing you want to do for preparation before deposition is serve your request for production. If you think there's any documents out there that you need to review or even want to see before you depose an individual, whether it's a party or a non-party, an expert witness, serve the request for production, get the expert witness report, get whatever else that opposing counsel has and go over it and have it with you when you do your deposition. You'll never know when a deponent may contradict something that's in there and you need them to explain it. Or they may say, I can't recall unless I look at a specific document that they gave you. So So if you have it with them, then you can finish up those questions. Make sure you do that. Another thing that's important to do if you're defending the deposition is to make sure you do witness preparation. Witness preparation is very important for a number of reasons, and it should start at the time that you let the witness know they're having a deposition taken, and assuming it's your own witness. Say a volunteer GAL is going to be deposed. When you send them the notice, if that's what you send them, the letter telling them about the deposition, you should include with it a prepared witness instruction sheet. And that's something that is going to be put onto the website and made available for everybody to have a standard witness instruction sheet that they can use when the deposition is scheduled. After you send them that, meet with the deponent before the depo. If it has to be the same day, you can do it the same day. I like to give myself a little bit of time, even if it's a phone conference, in case they tell me something that needs follow-up. If I do it the day of, I'm not going to have a chance to do the follow-up that's necessary. When you meet with them or talk to them, make sure you go over the facts in the file. Explain to them what a deposition is. Most lay witnesses are nervous just at the thought of being deposed. And just if you explain the procedures to them, that helps sort of allay their fears. Give them, again, the client instruction sheet you sent before. Ask them if they had any questions about it. And if you need to give them more specific instructions for this particular case, do that. And then lastly, practice a few questions with the deponent. And I strongly suggest and think you absolutely should practice certain basic questions such as best interest questions. Every JA volunteer is probably asked, what is your best interest opinion? Or if I were the parent's attorney, would. And make sure you give them the opportunity to practice articulating their answer to that, because with each time they do it, it will probably get fleshed out a little bit, get a little bit smoother, and they're less likely to forget something when they're answering that question in a deposition. Lastly, at the deposition, make sure you protect your client. Don't let opposing counsel beat up on them. If they're nervous, even if opposing counsel's not beating up on them, and, you know, make sure the deposition goes at a pace they're comfortable with. Make sure they know they can take a break if they need one. Make sure you protect your witness. At the deposition, one of the big topics that comes up, and I think is probably one of the sources of the most confusion among all attorneys, is that of objections. Really, there aren't very many that can be made at a deposition. Apart from privilege, which is built into the rule, you can't object to anything at a deposition except the form of the question. And that's where the waiver rule comes in. If you don't object to the form of a question at deposition, it's waived. So if you're not sure, make the objection. But saying objection alone is insufficient. You actually have to say objection form. Opposing counsel may ask you for specific grounds of the form objection, and you may need to give those. At deposition, if I have a question that I really want to make sure I get this answer in the record, and opposing counsel asks me for the objection for form, I will ask them the specific form objection to give me a chance to cure the question and ask it in a way that's non-objectionable. And I think also that attorneys are very clever, and if they simply say form and go back later, they can go through and find additional form objections they may have not have thought of. So I always like to ask them for important questions, their specific form objection. Objections for form are things such as lack of foundation, that the question was leading, that it's vague, that the witness lacks competency to answer the question, that there's a lack of foundation for the question, that the question mischaracterizes prior testimony, that it's a compound question, or that it calls for speculation. Now, one of the questions I get, and I actually get this objection often, is asked and answered. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier as far as the expert witness, is make sure you nail the answers for the very important questions down. And if you have to keep asking that particular question, even if it's slightly different, until you get the yes or no answer you need, then keep asking it again. Remember, if at depositions they can say asked and answered, they still have to answer. And if you think that by using a narrative, the party is giving you an answer you can't use, just say, all right, you testified to this. Does that mean yes? Does that mean no? And just keep saying, I'm not clear. Is that a yes or no? Until you get that question narrowed down for the information you really have to have on the record. Speaking objections are one of the biggest problems, in, I think, that are recognized in depositions. It, according to the rules, objections must be made in a non-argumentative and non-suggestive manner. Speaking objections are absolutely prohibited and actually can be grounds for sanctions. One of the items that will be on the website is the Florida Trial Lawyer's Handbook. It's updated through 2007. It goes through a lot more than just depositions. It has requests for produce, motions to compel, but it has a really nice section on speaking objections. And I have used it a lot, and I think that it's worth printing out and having with you. I think you would find it valuable to have in a lot of different instances. Some of the objections which would qualify as a speaking objection would be something such as, I object. The witness could not possibly know the answer to that. He wasn't there. Well, by saying that, it elicits the answer, I don't know, I wasn't there. They're pretty simple to really, if you think about it, figure out which ones would be. Another one would be, I object. You can answer if you remember. And then the witness says, of course, I don't remember. So just have to be careful about keeping your objections to the objection form or objection form with specified basis if you're asked that by opposing counsel. If you're not asked, leave it in objection form. Apart from speaking objections, though, there's a lot of behavior opposing counsel can behave in and that I've witnessed that can be really obstreperous and disrupt a deposition. They might make continual objections, give long-winded speeches. I've had opposing counsel yell at my witnesses. I've seen shaking of fingers. I've seen a lot of things like that. And even though you don't have a judge right there, apart from stopping a deposition, there are some things you can do. You can offer a continual objection for an attorney who just keeps making them and interrupts the flow of your deposition. You can, if they're giving speeches, you can request the court reporter bracket the speeches and tell opposing counsel you're going to ask for him to have to pay for that because you shouldn't have to pay for his speeches. If they're engaging in nonverbal behavior, passing notes, whispering in the client's ear, raising their voice, shaking of fingers, make sure you get that on the record. It's not going to show up unless you're videotaping. So you want to just say, let the record reflect opposing counsel has raised his voice in asking the questions of my witness, whatever it may be. Just get it on the record. If they're taking continual breaks to confer, just stopping, doing this, doing that, it's interrupting your deposition, start marking the time when the breaks start and stop. So you can show they spent a half an hour. It really, disrupted me. They spent 15 minutes, whatever it may be. Just make those because you may have to ask the court to go back and get some more time or whatever it may be. And if you have those breaks, and the court reporter will do it for you on record, it makes it a lot easier to go back. And that's particularly true if you only have a limited amount of time to conduct a deposition. The last thing with that is if you do take a recess for any reason, when the witness comes back, always ask them if they conferred with their attorney regarding the subject of the deposition. You can't ask them what was said, that's attorney-client privilege, but you can get on the record that we're talking about the answers, if they did. And then lastly, if their attorney is being really obstreperous, if they're trying to push you around, don't let them. Some attorneys will do it just to see if they can bully you. They will push you around as much as possible. Just remember it's your deposition, and just stick within the rules, but just tell them, it's my deposition, I'm going to plod along my way, let's just go forward. And don't let them, get to make it their deposition instead of yours. The last thing to be wary of in taking and in questioning in depositions is instructing a witness not to answer. You can't instruct a witness not to answer unless it's based on privilege. There are things you can do, though, if you think opposing counsel is acting in bad faith or they're asking about information which you think might be privileged or subject, it would be irreparable if revealed. It's hard for me to think of an instance in yours. I would think of, for me, trade secrets would come up often. And they might start asking questions which I didn't anticipate which would lead to trade secrets. And so I needed to say, can't answer that. I'm going to seek guidance from the judge. And Rule 1.310B allows you to do that. It says that at any time during the deposition, on motion of a party or the deponent, or upon a showing that the examination is being conducted in bad faith or such a manner as to unreasonably annoy, embarrass, or oppress the deponent or party, the court may limit the scope and manner of the deposition under Rule 1.280. And that allows you to suspend the deposition and go to the court and ask for an order regarding whether or not your witness has to answer those questions. Now, I always recommend that before you just adjourn the deposition, that you offer to opposing counsel, unless they're acting in really bad faith and they're just being terrible and really harassing your client, to try to finish the questions that are non-objectionable, so that if you do go to court and you do get the protective order, you don't have to answer it, you don't have to go back and finish the other ones. At deposition, also you need to consider the use and introduction of exhibits. Now, exhibits at deposition are very different than exhibits at trial, because generally you don't have to offer them in, and foundation is not always necessary for asking questions about an exhibit at deposition. If you're doing a discovery deposition and you anticipate that this witness or another witness will be available to lay the foundation, you don't have to lay one during the deposition. But if you are doing a deposition to perpetuate testimony, expert witness, something along those lines, then you do need to lay the foundation. You won't have another means to do it at trial. And sometimes if this witness that's being deposed can lay the foundation, you might want to go ahead and do it anyways. If nothing else, it's good practice. Plus, should the witness become unavailable, then you have the foundation laid for you. Laying a foundation for exhibits is difficult to compress and give you an easy 1, 2, 3. This is how you lay a foundation, because depending on the type of exhibit and the circumstances, foundations differ greatly. There is a book, Fundamentals of Trial Techniques, which is by an author, I pronounce Mauet, it's M-A-U-E-T. I was advised that you all have it available to you to consult for trial. If you can't find it, ask your supervising attorney. If your supervising attorney has an issue, have them consult the regional attorney, because I know that's available to you, and it has great sections on laying a foundation. But the basics of laying a foundation, you can boil down to a short checklist. And you should always have this checklist with you. Whether you're at trial, you're at deposition, you should have it. And the checklist consists of making sure the witness is qualified, do they have personal knowledge, authenticating the document. Authentication, again, that's going to vary by each and every one. But basically, it's just a chain of circumstantial evidence to show that this is the actual piece of evidence, whatever it may be. You want to establish relevance, and relevance here is not in the simple, you know, tend to prove or disprove a material fact, but they consider it more in Rule 403, which is whether or not the probative value is outweighed by the prejudicial value of the evidence. Best evidence rule sometimes will come into effect, and you need to make sure you address those, and then you have to have what is called the magic words. There's no specific ones, that's why they use that generic rubric, but basically you just need to ask, is the document, the piece of evidence, true and correct, and or a true and correct copy of the document. And then for certain documents, you're also going to need to establish the chain of custody. Again, going through those is for each one is necessary, because it differs based on the type, whether it's a photograph, demonstrative evidence, document, a business record. So consult Mouet and see if there isn't something in there about establishing the foundation for your particular piece of evidence. So using evidence at deposition, it's really simple, as I said. You don't have to offer it. You do want to have it marked. I like to mark, use the same ones over and over, and not have the same document marked at each person's deposition. If you're taking multiple ones, I'll just bring the prior ones that were marked and use that again as defendant's exhibit one. But that varies. You can do it how you prefer. But the most important thing when you're describing a document and using an exhibit at a deposition is to make sure you fully describe it each time you reference it. Don't just say exhibit A. If you're referring to page 3, say, referring you to guardian ad litem's exhibit A, page 3, on the center left-hand side where it says the mother failed to attend classes. Do you see that particular provision? And make sure that you go through each time and describe it that fully. Otherwise, the record can become very muddled, and it's really hard to know exactly what the witness was talking about and make sure that you can use that question if you need to for impeachment or if you need the deposition for some other purpose later. So make sure you describe it fully. And then make sure that you have copies of all the documents for all the parties, and make sure that you show, if it's not your witness, the other party's witness, lawyer, a copy of the document before you show it to the witnesses themselves. Lastly, I want to talk some about motions for protective orders. There's two things here. The first one I'm only going to touch upon briefly. The motions for protective orders will come up in your practice, I would think, most often with children under the age of 16. There is a specific provision in Rule 8.245, it's subsection I, on getting protective orders or limiting deposition circumstances for children the age of 16. As far as doing for protective orders, asking the questions, doing all of that, I think that that can be much more developed, and I know that Mary Kay is going to schedule another conference call to fully go through child depositions and child witnesses, because it just can be so complicated as far, or so different than your normal practice. So look forward to that coming in the future. But just very generally, what I would say is that first thing you need to do is, if another party seeks to depose a child, and this is the policy for the program, is you have to look at the age and the maturity of the child. And if the child is old enough and mature enough and tells you they want to testify, then let them be deposed. I mean, some older kids, I think, find it empowering to testify, and they also want to be able to go in and confront the abuser. Some don't, and some are just too young. If you have the circumstances where they don't want to go in, they don't want to testify, be deposed, or at least not deposed in front of the people that they're saying abuse them, make sure you file a motion for a protective order. And then try to resolve it with the other attorneys before you go in. You might be able to. Some people will try to resolve it first. I always file my motion first because I'm afraid that if I don't get the motion on file, that should the talks fall through, I won't have time to get it in front of the court and get the protective order before the deposition is scheduled. So I always do a motion first and then talk to the parties later. But if you have very cooperative department or parent lawyers, you may want to just talk to them. The other type of motion for protective order, there's an entire list under 8.245F, one which I think would come up in your practice more often than not is subsection 5, which provides that discovery should be conducted with no one present except persons designated by the court. I think this rule would be very helpful for limiting the attendance of non-parties. It occurred to me that you probably have situations where you have, I think you call them paramours, boyfriends or girlfriends, that are non-parties that might want to attend the deposition. There is no invoking the rule. It's not like trial where you can say, they're a witness, I'm invoking the rule, I don't want them sitting here. You can't do that. It just doesn't exist in discovery. So if you think that there's going to be another party there or another person whose testimony you don't want to be influenced by listening to the deposition you're taking, then you need to file a motion for a protective order. In the situation I just gave, if there's a mother or father and then a boyfriend, girlfriend, when I scheduled the depositions, I would schedule and consider the order the mother or father first, because a party always has a right, or almost always has a right, there is the children's rule, to be present at the deposition. So if you're not going to be able to limit them from being there when their paramour is there, but if you depose the parent first, then the boyfriend or girlfriend's not going to have the benefit of having listened to the parent when they're being deposed. So the protective order really will only benefit you if you do it with the parent or the party or whoever the party may be first, and then the non-party being deposed after you've gotten the parent's testimony or the party's testimony on record. That provision also applies and also has other uses. If you think there's confidential information, if you think opposing party may ask questions of the guardian ad litem that don't relate to the case or that might be embarrassing to them, something along those lines, go in beforehand and ask for a protective order. Just go to the court, seek to limit the testimony, and use it any time that you think some sort of confidential information came up. It's something that's always there and available, and something that courts will, you know, be sensitive to information such as that. So make sure you use it. And those are the 6 points that I wanted to cover. I wanted to make sure to leave time for questions. I had a few things that were sent in. So if anybody has any questions at this point, I'm happy to open it up to that.